Well, the man said, we're gonna start it off. We're gonna start it off. We're gonna start it off. And then he said, we're gonna start it off. We're gonna start it off. We're gonna start it off.
This is episode number 12. Pretty excited that we're still going. We're still going strong. You'll notice sometimes there's a few longer delays in between episodes. What can I say other than it's just life? I'm a one-man team and try to do what I can, but sometimes life gets in the way with my daughter and anniversary we just had with my wife and all the different things that I tend to get involved with. So I apologize, and I thank you for bearing with me with patience. I really appreciate it. I think you'll really like our guest for today's podcast. Her name is Rachel Held Evans. She wrote a spiritual memoir a couple years ago, called Evolving in Monkey Town, about her life growing up in Dayton, Tennessee, the site of the Scopes Monkey Trials from way back when, and just kind of how she herself evolved spiritually to where she is today. She is right now working on a new project called, it doesn't technically have an official title yet, but she calls it the Biblical Womanhood Project, or the Womanhood Project, where she is attempting to live an entire year biblically as a woman, with all of the the commands and the guidelines for what a woman is, or at least the descriptions that are provided in Scripture for a woman, things like the Proverbs 31 woman, things like how she is to submit to her husband and things like that, and she's living out that experiment. And I think you'll really enjoy the interview as she shares a little bit of what she's learned so far through it. She's not all the way through. I believe she still has about less than 6 months left to go, but she shares some of her experiences she's had and what she's learned. And that leads me to want to reach out to my female audience. What do you think about biblical womanhood? Have you thought about it, considered it before? There's a lot of movements out there that kind of push it and hold it up. She mentions a few in the interview, and maybe you can check out some of that. You can, of course, go to her website and check out what she's doing, rachelheldevans.com, and kind of see the impetus behind what she's doing. And I'd just like to hear from you. What is your take on it? Have you ever thought about it? Have you ever tried anything like what she's doing? Maybe you already live out some of these things that she will be talking about, things like making your own clothes and providing, being the one in charge of the household day-to-day living. Love to hear from you and to see what your experience has been, and just get your take on that. But I really think you'll enjoy the talk. I look forward to hearing any comments that we get from you. And thanks again for listening. So, Rachel, thank you so much for agreeing to do this with me. I appreciate it.
Sure, no problem.
First of all, I read your blog from earlier, and I just want to say, you know, my condolences to you and the church there that happened. So,
thanks.
I know that's a tough time.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, you know, and it was really encouraging to hear from so many people just encouraging us and saying that they had traveled similar roads and just you know, expressing so much love and encouragement. That really made a big difference. I was feeling kind of down today. And then, you know, when I started reading the comments, it really lifted my spirits. So, I mean, it's tough when you try to plant a church and it basically fails. But it's good to know that we're part of a bigger church family.
Right. So. What are some things you've learned from that venture that you could take?
That you need money to start a church, number one. I think I learned, you know, a lot about myself and what I'm good at and what I'm not so great at. And, you know, we learned a lot because we were a small group. We learned a lot about loving each other through theological and political differences. And I was really, really proud that our little church was very diverse in that way. And I learned a lot about being patient and holding back and focusing on what's important and not letting those little differences get in the way of community. So I really appreciate that. Yeah, but mostly we learned that you need money to start a church and lots of it.
Yeah, that is very true. So can you tell me just a little bit about yourself, like where you grew up and just kind of a little background?
Sure. Yeah, I grew up in, I was born in Birmingham, Alabama, so I'm an Alabama football fan, Roll Tide. Moved to Dayton, Tennessee when I was about 12, and Dayton is the home of the famous Scopes Monkey Trial of 1925. So it's a very much buckle of the Bible Belt sort of a culture. And so I spent my teens and then college years here. I attended Bryan College, which is named after William Jennings Bryan, who was the prosecutor against John T. Scopes in the trial. And have met my husband Dan there at Bryan, and we've kind of settled here in Dayton. So, and yeah, is that what you wanted to know?
Yeah, that's perfect. Now, okay. So with that background, your first book was Evolving in Monkey Town.
Right.
And I haven't read it yet, but I look forward to sometime. And
oh, it'll be the best book you've ever read in your life.
Nice.
I get
little. I like an author with some confidence. That's good.
Yeah, I'm trying to project confidence there.
But you do have a background where have you yourself changed your views on creation evolution, or have you always been? I assume you accept evolution as true.
I do, okay. Yes. I mean, I grew up in an environment that was very, very pro-creationism. So that was a difficult change for me to make just because it was such a part of my culture and my upbringing. And, you know, most of my friends and family, they believe that the earth is young and that, you know, evolution. They make a distinction between macro and microevolution. We won't get into all that. But, you know, so that was a departure from sort of what I had been raised to believe. But, yeah, I just sort of over time, as I began studying on my own, sort of outside the Christian culture and the context of a Christian education, just came to realize that, you know, the evidence is very overwhelming and it seems to support, you know, Darwin's theory. And so, yeah, I've kind of gradually evolved to accept that. But, you know, and people are sometimes surprised to find out that in the book, I don't write that much about evolution. I maybe mention it two or three times, and then I include a little bit of, you know, backstory about the Scopes trial. But the book is much more about just how faith evolves, how when it's challenged, it has to adapt to new environments and stretch and grow and change. So it was more of a metaphor than a topic. Some Christian bookstores didn't get that message. but yeah, but myself personally, yeah, I do tend to think that the earth is old and that sort of thing. But it's one of those things where it's like, if people have a different opinion on that, that's okay. I'm not, you know, I don't look down on people who think differently than me.
You mentioned that the focus, though, is kind of a memoir of faith evolving in maybe a different environment. And you talked about maybe some pressures, and I assume you meant outside pressures, but also internally there was probably some pressure, right? I mean, as you were coming to a comprehensive understanding of evolution, you probably had to rethink a lot of things in terms of your faith.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I think when you make that change, some people will jump so quickly to it, they fail to sort of appreciate the theological questions that this does raise. And so I don't want to gloss over this because, it raises questions about, you know, Adam and Eve and about, you know, what we understand to be the fall and questions about death and how we relate to death and what death means for us and how it's sort of always been a part of the process. And, you know, that sort of raises questions about, you know, some theology, and that does depend a little bit on your tradition too, the degree to which it sort of impacts your theology. I know that for my Calvinist friends, it's a little harder. You know, for the Reformed folks, that the fall and that sort of thing is very central to their theology. And so anytime you kind of mess with that or raise questions about that, it causes some tension. And, you know, I get that. I really do. So definitely, I have wrestled through a lot of these questions and you know, accepting evolution raised some questions in my own heart and in my own life about you know, what kind of God would create this world where, you know, 99% of its inhabitants have been extinct and are gone extinct. And, you know, that does raise some questions. And you think about how small we are when you look at the expanse of time, the expanse of the universe. All of that can make you go into a little existential crisis every time you watch, like, you know, National Geographic. But that's part, to me, that's part of faith. It's not supposed to be easy. It's, you know, there are times that questions challenge it and can make it tough. So, yeah, but I've definitely wrestled with those and continue to wrestle with those. And I just try to, the best thing I've found is to try and find other people who are asking the same questions, having the same struggles, because a lot of times they might offer some insights that I hadn't thought about, and I can offer them some insights maybe they hadn't thought about.
Yeah, very true. How about with your spouse, Dan, there? Has he gone along the same journey, or was he ahead of you, behind you?
I think he was secretly ahead of me. Just didn't say anything about it. I'm like the person who, like, I arrive at these conclusions and have these thoughts and I make this big deal about it and I put it on my blog and I write books. And like, he's been thinking about all of this the whole time. He just hasn't been making a big deal about it. So he and I have been on very similar journeys. And the great thing I write about this in the book is that Dan, you know, even when I really am struggling with pretty serious doubts, he's never tried to fix me, which a lot of people, a lot of well-meaning Christians try to do. They see me as a problem that needs to be fixed, you know, a liability. And he has always sort of just given me the space to grow, which I think is the best thing a spouse can offer. And really, it's to me, that's a good sign of leadership, too. A lot of times people think that leadership or, you know, is something where one person sort of pulls the other person along. But I found in our relationship, it really thrives when we've given one another the space to grow, sometimes in different directions, but you know, we've tended to grow in similar ways.
Mm, yep. So maybe you two just process a little differently. And so he's more of a quiet processor and right. more of a, I need to think out loud and, you know.
Basically, he's smarter than me, but yeah, that's yeah. He's more of an internal processor, and I'm sort of just the one who drags everything out in front of everybody. So we're actually a pretty good match for each other because of that.
Nice. So talk to me a little bit about the Womanhood Project. How's that going? And for my listeners who maybe haven't been following along on your blog, can you give them just a taste of what it's all about?
Sure. Well, my second book is with Thomas Nelson, and tentatively titled, I don't know if we'll stick with this, A Year of Biblical Womanhood. And the goal is sort of to explore every passage that I can find in the Bible that touches in any way on womanhood and women, you know, explore those, research them, read up on those. And then I've been interviewing women from different religious traditions and Christian traditions who maybe interpret and apply the Bible a little bit differently in their lives. So I've been corresponding with an Orthodox Jew, a polygamist. I went to Amish country. So I'm really trained to get a variety of perspectives. And then on top of that, I'm trying to observe as many of the instructions for women that are found in the Bible as I can, as literally as possible for this year. And each month I kind of focus on a different virtue. So I've been focusing recently on modesty. So I've been keeping my head covered at all times. I've been wearing long dresses, no jewelry. And then later this month, I'll be actually observing Nidah, I think is how they say it, the Orthodox Jews, which is family purity, which means I'll be basically removing myself from the home for a few special days, and I can't touch my husband at all. Everything I sit on is unclean, you know, the whole nine yards. So it's been a really interesting year. I'm about halfway through the project. I started in October, and I've done quite a few crazy stunts. I turned Proverbs 31 into a to-do list, which was definitely the hardest month, only to find out from my Orthodox Jewish friend that they don't really read Proverbs 31 as like a to-do list or prescriptive. It's more of a blessing. So like her husband says that to her after their Sabbath meal every Sunday as sort of a way of just praising her. And she said, even if she hasn't, you know, been the perfect wife that week, it's just part of, it's like an affirmation. Of course, I found this out after I had turned it into like 31 things to do in 31 days. It was awful. So, so it's been a crazy year, but I'm at the halfway point. So I'm very happy.
And you've been just journaling through this, and that's what you'll turn into the book later.
Yeah. Well, I was going to try and actually turn in chapters incrementally, like as I went along. But I'm running a little behind on the writing just because, yeah, living biblically turns out to take quite a bit of time. Like this week I was purging my house of everything with yeast, you know, because it was, yeah. So I'm running a little behind on the writing. So I have been journaling and I'm hoping to catch up on the writing this summer. But I'd like to turn it all in at the end of the year by September.
Wow.
Yeah, I hope I can do that.
So what gave you this idea? I mean, what was the impetus behind it? Was it, I mean, I assume A.J. Jacobs and the Year of Living Biblically was mm-hmm. probably an inspiration. Anything else?
Yeah, that was definitely a big inspiration because I remember reading that book thinking, wow, this would be totally different if a woman was doing it. But even more so, the phrase biblical womanhood gets thrown around a lot, and there is a movement, particularly in evangelicalism, that really advocates, you know, biblical womanhood. And that always sort of troubled me just because, and what does that even mean? I mean, does the Bible really just have one thing to say about what it means to be a woman? Is it really harmonious on this? Is it really, you know, unified? Because it's, you know, technically speaking, it's biblical for a woman to be sold by her father to pay off debt. You know, it's biblical for her to be one of many wives. It's biblical for her to cover her head when she prays. Paul says a woman who prays without her head covered disgraces her head. So I've always been very interested in this whole, just even using the word, using the Bible as an adjective like that, you know, has always been very interesting to me because it's just fraught with problems, you know. So I was just really interested in exploring this, mainly because I'm hoping, I'm trying to make the book kind of lighthearted, but also encouraging. I'm hoping that women will cut each other and themselves a little more slack when they realize that none of us are actually living out biblical womanhood fully. So maybe we should be a little kinder to each other. Maybe we should respect some of these differences of interpretation. Since none of us have got this thing figured out. So that's kind of the goal that I have going into it. And yeah.
Have you? One question that I had was, when you started undertaking this project, did you notice that anyone who, maybe from your family or something like that, who you said would always try to fix you, they're like, they jumped in wholeheartedly backing you up on this, like, yeah, you've got to be, this is great, this will, maybe she'll learn something out of this.
My family's been very cool, and they totally kind of get where I'm coming from, but then it is funny, I'll encounter other people who I don't really know whether they, I don't know, it's hard sometimes to feel out what, if people understand where I'm coming from on this, because they'll say, I really admire how you've thrown yourself into biblical womanhood. And I'll say, do you really know everything that I'm doing? Because some of it's a little bit crazy, you know. So, you know, people, it's one of those things. And I was warned actually by a woman who is pretty prominent in the complementarian world. And, you know, I come from a more egalitarian perspective. She has been very gracious and encouraging to me. And she warned me that when you start talking about this topic, about biblical womanhood or about womanhood and the church, women in the church, prepare for the worst, harshest criticism of your life. And she was right. And it's, you know, people have sent some kind of mean messages and, you know, on the blog. And I expect that it'll probably get even more intense as the book comes out. Just because, and I get it, I totally get it, because a lot of women have made some of the most important decisions of their life based on their understanding of how to interpret the Bible and what it says about womanhood. And so as soon as you suggest, well, maybe there's another way, or maybe this view is just as valid as that view, or maybe we should cut each other some slack, people get very defensive. And I totally understand why. I mean, people have made career decisions based on this. They've chosen to have children or not to have children based on this. And so that's deeply, deeply personal. So my goal from the beginning has been to try and turn all of the humor on myself, not on other people or on the Bible, and to, you know, just honestly wrestle through the good and the bad that I find as a woman in the Bible. And some people are going to get that and love it and understand it, and some people are going to just hate it from the beginning. And I've kind of learned to accept that. You know, I've been blogging for, I guess, about 3.5-4 years, you sort of just learn to accept people not liking you and not liking what you have to say. You kind of get over yourself, you know. So if people don't get it or don't like it, that's okay. It seems to have struck a nerve just already on the blog with a lot of women. So I'm hoping that if I can keep the tone right and, you know, like I said, turn the humor on myself, that it will be successful, and that women will start to have more productive dialogues with each other about this issue.
Speaking of the dialogues, you did mention that you already interviewed people from different backgrounds and traditions, or are you still in the process of interviewing them?
Still in the process. I've gotten some, like I went to Amish country back in March. And so I got to interview some Amish ladies and Old Order Mennonite ladies. And I've had a really, really productive, interesting conversation with an Orthodox Jewish woman who lives in Israel. Most of this is just via email. But I have learned so, she knows so much more about Christianity than I know about Judaism. It's been embarrassing. But she has just been an open book and has been so helpful to me, especially with some of this Old Testament stuff that is kind of unfamiliar. I interviewed by email a polygamous woman. I'm trying to think who else. And then I'm hoping, you know, I'm trying to schedule some interviews in the future. Maybe with Catholic nuns, maybe with, I'd really like to talk with a Quiverful family, like the Duggars, you know, like on TLC, somebody like that. I have a family in mind for that. Or if I can reach the Duggars, that would be awesome. So, yeah, and I've really enjoyed this part of it. I did journalism for many years and worked as a reporter. So I've always loved interviews. I just love hearing other people's stories. So I'm hoping that by integrating some of those into the book, I'll fairly represent other people's views and, you know, just sort of, it'll be more interesting instead of just going on and on about what I did. People get to hear how some women are doing some of these things always, you know? Yeah, that like the family purity laws, my Orthodox Jewish friend, she does that. That's part of her life, you know? So I'm really interested in how she navigates that, you know?
Yeah. Have you mentioned that the Proverbs 31 thing was kind of a pretty hard thing when you made it a checklist. Was there anything that you have done already that you thought was going to be really hard, but then when you did it, you're like, you know what, actually, that wasn't too bad. I could do that.
Oh, you know, definitely. The modesty thing, the covering, this is crazy. But like, I went without makeup and everything. It was just so much easier to get ready in the morning. It sounds dumb, but it saved me so much time. I just put a hat on my head and didn't have to worry about my hair. I didn't have to worry about makeup. I was pretty much wearing the same outfits every day. And so I thought that being sort of a liberated feminist type woman, that I would feel really, I don't know, oppressed during this whole modesty thing. But I actually really liked it. I guess maybe I just liked the time-saving element. I don't know. I mean, maybe I let it go too far and I kind of got to be a slob, but, you know, I really like just throwing on a hat every day. Just made life so much simpler. And if I was having a bad hair day, nobody knew. So, yeah, that was surprisingly easy. I actually enjoy some of the homemaking type tasks that I've had to do. I like to cook. I enjoy cooking. I hate to clean. But the Proverbs 31, the problem with that was that there was a lot of sewing involved. And I am, like, so not crafty. I hate anything that I have to do with my hands, like, with scissors. I can't cut in a straight line. So what I ended up doing, and this was good because it taught me a lot about asking for help. I had about four huge, like, I had to make a dress, I had to make a scarf, I had to make a pillow. And I just ended up inviting some ladies from my parents' church over to help. I called it like a Proverbs 31 party and basically delegated it all. And my husband comes home and he's like, wow, it all got done in an afternoon. But I didn't really, I maybe sewed a few seams, you know. So the Proverbs 31 woman did have servant girls. So there. I sort of feel like there's my out. But yeah, I got a lot of help on the Proverbs 31 thing, but that was a tough month. I had a few moments of, you know, and it was kind of early in the project. So I was like, this is a dumb idea. I'm going to waste a whole year of my life. You know, so that was definitely the low moment so far.
One of you posted the 10 commandments that you're following, when you go throughout here, and the first one, thou shalt submit to thy husband's will in all things. How's that going?
It's weird because, you know, I wrote a blog post about this the other day, how Dean and I, believe it or not, I mean, I'm a liberated woman, but I do believe that submission is important in any relationship. And so Dean and I sort of had just fallen naturally into a mutually submissive pattern. I think that's how strong marriages typically operate, is that sometimes you just put the other person's needs above your own and, you know, you let stuff go, or you let them take the lead or whatever. So we had just sort of naturally settled into mutually submissive, egalitarian type of relationship. So when I started the project, I really tried to be a lot more deliberate about submitting to what Dan wants to do. And so it turned a little bit more into the hierarchical thing, which was totally new to us because we never really operated in that way. It wasn't like he's in charge, I do whatever he says, you know. We went about, I don't know how well I've kept that commandment because it just feels so unnatural to try and force that. I mean, Dan is just a wonderful human being who I respect so much, and I tend to take his advice and follow his lead naturally. So trying to sort of force onto what is naturally working for us, a hierarchical, he's in charge thing, I think could actually be harder on the relationship than it needs to be. So, I mean, there have been in certain circumstances, I've, you know, really tried to focus on that. But, you know, we tend to slip back into just our regular pattern of living. One exception to that was during my month of obedience, there's a passage in 1 Peter that says, you know, imitate Sarah, who submitted to her husband and called him master. So I called Dan master for a week, which of course got us some looks at the restaurant and, you know, it was a little weird, but we had fun with it. We kind of did the whole I dream of Jeannie thing where I just said, yes, master, you know. So that was a little weird. But yeah, it's just, it's very interesting. We trying to impose on an egalitarian marriage, you know, sort of hierarchy, you know, it just feels a little weird. And we were happy before it. We don't really feel like we need that in our lives. And I respect and get why some people like to have a very defined leader and a very defined follower. If that works better for their marriage, okay. You know, I personally don't think that that's prescribed by God in some ways, but, you know, if it works for other people and it's agreed upon together, I don't have a huge problem with that. It just never really worked for us. Yeah.
Has Dan ever tried to take advantage of it, like say with a movie choice or something?
Right. Sometimes he will, like, he'll have fun with it and sort of be like, submit, like he has this sort of phrase that he uses, like he'll point his finger and say submit, but he's usually just kidding around, you know. So, I mean, we haven't had any like huge family decisions where it's been like, I must submit to his authority or anything. So mostly we've kind of had fun with it. Yeah. And like I said before, I really genuinely respect Dan and his opinion, and he's very wise. And so following him is usually pretty easy. But yeah, I mean, we've done the movie choice thing. Like, I think I mentioned this on the blog. He was like, you've never seen Mad Max, which, believe me, I was just as, you know, it was better before I had seen Mad Max. So I think we ended up watching that instead of Persepolis. Because he doesn't like foreign films so much. He don't like to read the, you know. So that was kind of a funny example of submission. But, you know, that's been the bulk of it.
Nice. You do mention in some of your posts that there is a darker side, an underbelly. Have you gotten any stories from people who, and obviously you don't need to share any names or anything, but who have dealt with the abuse and really touched you with their stories?
Yes, I'm so glad you brought this up. I've heard from a lot of women, actually. And, you know, so this is something I'm definitely going to have to address in the book. But there are so many situations in where this submission thing is used, to justify the worst kinds of abuse and to perpetuate very bad circumstances. And in a lot of cases, churches will sort of cover things up. So yes, and you know, I've encountered some cool women doing some cool things. There is a girl who she wrote a book called No Longer Quivering. Her name's Hillary McFarland, and she's obviously very open to sharing about these things because she's sort of been a part of the patriarchal movement. So I suggest, you know, if people are interested in learning more, they could check out that book. Or there's a book called Quiverful that sort of is a basic introduction to, you know, modern day patriarchy and it touches on some of the abuses. And, you know, just today, and I'm going to have to probably write a post about this or something, I saw a video with John Piper actually was asked, what about women, should women submit who are in abusive relationships. And I was really surprised. He said that some women should submit and endure physical abuse for a time. It was really surprising because, I mean, I've got my bones to pick with John Piper. I mean, everybody knows that. But that was just, you know, I mean, he couched it a little bit, but there's, and then he said that women in that situation should, if there's physical abuse or emotional abuse or verbal abuse, should bring this to the church for church discipline. Nothing was said about contacting the authorities, you know, and that is something I have heard over and over and over again. If you're in an abusive situation, submit to it, submit to God, submit to your husband, bring it before the church. So it's sort of kept hush hush, you know, and I think that is very, very dangerous to be putting that out there. So I'm going to probably have to address this in a post or something because, you know, the other day I wrote a post about, you know, submission isn't all bad and, you know, how, you know, if you have an attitude of humility towards your spouse, you're going to be submitting anyway. But I feel, after seeing that, I feel a real need to make sure that I clarify, if you are in an abusive situation, get out, get help, you know, find a domestic abuse organization in the area, contact the authorities. You know, in my mind, I've lived a very, you know, safe sort of life and existence. And so I forget sometimes that just how badly that word submission has been abused and used to perpetuate abuse. So, you know, every now and then I get these sudden reminders that, gosh, I need to make sure I'm being very clear that, you know, I celebrate submission when it's mutual and when it's deliberate and people are trained to put their spouse above themselves, but never is this idea of submission a justification for staying in an abusive relationship.
Yeah, no kidding. So my last question then is combining the thoughts from your first memoir about evolving, and you've been on this project for 6 months. Have you noticed that you've been evolving in any way, like some things changing about you as in terms of how you view womanhood yourself?
Yeah, you know, I have. I think I've come to appreciate other people's perspectives a little bit more, and I find myself not making the same sort of caricatures that maybe I used to. I've learned that people are people no matter what their religious system is or their tradition. You know, sometimes you expect Amish women to have these totally different personalities or, you know, but people are people, you know, and that's been kind of fun. And I think the biggest thing I've learned is that I believe that God can both inhabit and transcend our religious practices. So, for instance, you know, covering my head when I pray, there is a degree to which that makes me feel more reverent, more, I pay more attention because I'm doing some sort of physical deliberate act. And so I can kind of understand why some women feel that they should do that. And I get how that can be enriching. And yet I don't think one has to. I don't think God is contained to that head covering. So I'm learning to navigate that gray where it's, I believe that God can inhabit this action, but he also transcends it. He's not confined to it. And that's really been the same thing with working in the home. I think that a lot of people in the biblical womanhood movement feel that, you know, working from the home as a housewife has sort of been looked down upon recently in the U.S. and in Western culture. And you know what? I think they're right. And we really should celebrate homemaking as a profession. But I don't think sometimes they go too far and they say that one must be a homemaker in order to honor God. So while I believe, just like, you know, Brother Lawrence referred to the God of pots and pans, I mean, God is present in the home and with women who are homemakers. That's a beautiful God-glorifying profession, but I don't think he's limited there. You know, if he's the God of pots and pans, he's also the God of, you know, boardrooms and classrooms and typewriters, goodness, I've been watching too much Mad Men, computers, you know. So I think that's been the biggest thing it for me, is just to recognize and appreciate that God can be found in these actions and these rituals and these things that I'm taking on, but he's certainly not confined to them.
Absolutely. Rachel, again, thank you so much for agreeing to do this. It's a
terribly interesting
project, and I look forward to the book. So, all right, Rachel, we'll talk again soon, I hope.
Sounds great, Cody. I really appreciate it.
Once again to Rachel DeHeld Evans for agreeing to sit down and let me interview her and sharing what she's learned so far on her womanhood project, 1 year of living biblically, living biblical womanhood. I think you will agree it's very interesting stuff what she's doing. You can go check out her website. I'll provide, there's information on the blog for that in the post so that you can click on and follow the link to get to her website. Check out what she's doing there, because she does a lot of great things aside from this, but this is just kind of her one-year project she's working on. And again, I'd love to hear from the female members of my audience to hear your take on biblical womanhood, what you think about it. Do you think there is such thing as biblical womanhood, or if it's just kind of a cultural expressions that are being described in the Bible, or if you think they're prescriptions for women to follow all throughout time, or you think they're timeless prescriptions about what a woman should be. I'd love to hear your take on that. Doesn't mean I don't want to hear from the guys either. I want to hear what your take is on biblical womanhood as well, but I really want to hear from the ladies. You can follow along on Twitter, of course. You can find me at We Are Becoming. That's my Twitter name, at We Are Becoming. You can send an email. wearebecoming@gmail.com. You can follow us on Facebook and drop a note there, www.facebook.com/wearebecoming, all one word. Or, of course, you can leave a comment in the post here, www.becomingprocess.blogspot.com. Love to hear from you. I love to get your input. You can also check out our upcoming guests who will be on the show here in the future. Got some really good guests planned. It's going to be some great shows and podcasts. And maybe a couple of other tidbits you can find. You can find, of course, essays from some past guests. We've got an essay from Kenton Lee of Because International, who will be it'll be up here. We got essays from Reverend Gene Anderson and a couple of my own as well. So be sure to check that out too and leave comments on those. I'd love to get some more interaction going on in terms of discussion there. I appreciate you listening. Appreciate you following. Appreciate just your time that you spend listening to me ramble and ramble. But anyway, I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. Remember, life is change. Growth is optional. Choose wisely.
Please remember me when I'm gone. Smile when you think about me singing you this song. And I will look above the clouds into the great mysterious blue and think about you singing along. Now when I'm looking at you, all I see is a melody arranged in triplet form, sung so soft. And so it seems, even if I lose the moment or the tune, I'll think about you singing to me. La 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 la. La 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 la. La 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 la. Remember me.